From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump heads to Asia tomorrow, 12 days in total, 5 countries. All eyes are on his visit, especially to China. North Korea's nuclear threat looms large. The administration wants the Chinese to step up. On trade, Trump called the trade deficit with China embarrassing, horrible. And Chinese President Xi Jinping, solidifying his power, tightening control over the Communist Party and his country, announcing a new era of Chinese power. This hour, On Point, what awaits President Trump in the region and Asia's great power, China? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you white-knuckled on the North Korea nukes and war threat? And how should the U.S. relate to the mounting power of China? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from Washington is Margaret Brennan, White House and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for CBS News. She'll be traveling with the president on his Asia trip. Margaret Brennan, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Bags are packed.
Bags are packed. I bet they are. And off you go with the president tomorrow. Walk us through this trip. What's coming, Margaret?
Well, this is arguably the most significant trip that President Trump has undertaken in the 9 months or so of this presidency, because it is so high stakes, not only with this nuclear threat of North Korea overhanging the entire region. He comes, as you pointed out, to Beijing at a very key time. Xi Jinping, the leader there, really consolidating, solidifying his hold on power. And remember, this question of can China and the U.S. be two competing powers, or one rising, one existing power, and not clash? Right now, President Trump's going to arrive there and really try to confront Xi Jinping to do more to push back against North Korea. And this time, Xi Jinping can't really say, I don't have the power to do that. It's going to be a matter of, does he want to? So China's really going to be a big centerpiece of this trip, but we've also got stops in Japan, in South Korea, then on to Vietnam, and we'll end up in the Philippines. The theme throughout is pushing back against North Korea. Unclear how tough the pushback will be against China's expansion in the region.
The visits to Japan and South Korea, I mean, these come at a time when we've had General Mattis, the defense secretary, right there on the DMZ, sort of in North Korea's face, saying, you know, don't mess with us, and demanding that they drop their nuclear program. They show no signs of doing that. We've had, the vice president of the United States at the nuclear missile silos in Minot, North Dakota, talking about the strength of American nuclear power, and the president of the United States talking about annihilating North Korea if they cross certain kind of vague lines. I mean, Japan and South Korea must be looking for signals about, among other things, whether the U.S. is really contemplating war.
Well, that is why there are just such high stakes. I mean, trips to Asia are usually very scripted. This is a very unscripted president. And as you point out, that the kind of a symbolism of even visiting the DMZ, that 38th parallel, the line dividing North and South Korea, really the line between war, to still technically at war states, is something that the president's not going to risk. He's not going to set foot there. That's not the plan. He's
yeah.
going to instead try to emphasize that the U.S. stands by its ally, its military ally, South Korea, and go out and visit Camp Humphreys, a military base there that fits in a bit with the Trump administration narrative of saying we want our allies to pay more for the military support that we extend in their backyards. Camp Humphreys is an operation there that the South Koreans have contributed financially to in a significant way. So what we do know is, as you point out, there are very mixed messages, at least not clear communication thus far from the Trump administration about exactly what a diplomatic solution could be or would be. But the one very clear thing coming out of the Trump White House is that they are not interested in direct talks with Kim Jong-un. So far, any extension of the offer has been turned down and has not been responded to or given any positive signals that there's a breakthrough underway, though Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is trying to use diplomatic power to pressure him. And that means sanctions to get North Korea to not be able to to continue to afford to develop their program, but also get some of our friends and those we can influence in the region to stop doing any kind of business with North Korea that would allow them to bring in more money.
Margaret, who is preparing the president for this trip? We know how much work typically goes into presidential trips, especially very big high-stakes ones like this, as you say. But both in terms of preparation, I mean, we've got a State Department that's been just gutted in any number of dimensions, lots of posts not filled there. What about the pre-prep? And then as the president travels, who's going to be right around him? We know he's a very in-the-moment guy. Who's going to be guiding or advising the president on these crucial interactions as he spends this time in Asia?
Well, you're right. There's always this jockeying for influence among top advisors, and that is really pronounced with this administration. The National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, would typically be in the position to exert perhaps the most, or at least be the final line between the national security team and the president himself. But that's not clear whether that is actually how things are playing out with the Trump administration. We do know on this trip, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who the president has said very clearly and very publicly they don't exactly agree on North Korea, will be by the president's side through most of the stops on this trip. And that seems to be an effort, a joint effort by the defense secretary and the secretary of state to say this is the solution preferred to settle this diplomatically, and we will have America's top diplomat out there speaking to the press, speaking and appearing in all of these stops to send that signal. But H.R. McMaster will be briefing the press later today, and he will be with the president as well in those meetings to also represent what is very clear, which is that he has continued to present military options to the president, and the president has been briefed on them. The military options may not be good ones, but they are ones that the White House has prepared in this just-in-case scenario. And so it's that carrot-and-stick sort of presentation of strategy, but as you say, it's not one that appears to have been really uniformly laid out throughout the national security establishment. Right now, there are a lot of vacancies at the State Department. There is skeleton staffing, and most notably, most pronounced here in terms of the ambassadorial vacancy, we don't have a top diplomat in South Korea, in Seoul. We don't have that first point of contact for our nervous allies to pick up the phone to talk to the president's advisor in their own backyard, which is typically what the ambassador would be doing and helping to coordinate between all of the agencies that keep a presence in an American embassy. You know, some would say this seasoned diplomat I recently interviewed really compared it to having a government without a president. You know, you have an ambassador that runs this little mini government in-house, in-country, and we don't have one right now. We have people who are filling those slots on an acting basis, but no one with the authority of the president behind him or her in Seoul right now.
I mean, it leaves one wondering whether this president, with his character, is going to be calling audibles as he travels through Asia, sort of going ad hoc on the road. Let's come to China, if we may, because he's visiting China at such an interesting time. They've just had this big party congress where Xi Jinping, the president there, has apparently been granted what could be a much longer time in office. He's been lifted up to this vaunted status, in some ways on a par with Mao Zedong about his way of thinking. And he has come out leaving old Deng Xiaoping thinking when it comes to foreign policy behind in many ways. Deng, who set the course for many years, said China should hide its light under a bushel, bide its time, sort of be very low profile on the international stage. And now Xi Jinping is talking about China having arrived at an historic juncture, entering a new era when China should become a mighty force in the world and, you know, project its system, very critical of the West and democracy here. I mean, President Trump's spoken admiringly about Xi Jinping as just a power projector. But how do the two agendas of these countries meet as Donald Trump meets Xi Jinping there?
It's going to be fascinating because of everything you just described. Xi Jinping seems to be a very different kind of leader, making a very unique role for himself within that power structure already, you know, the authoritarian in many ways, but has now sort of shown a different side to China's potential foreign policy. And the question that the U.S. is sort of pressing on them is, if you want to be a world power, will you take on the responsibilities of upholding world order? What does that mean? That means going ahead with more sanctions on North Korea, pressuring them, being responsible, saying, you know, if you don't want us to, quote unquote, solve this problem, you need to take the reins here. But it's not clear that Xi Jinping or his establishment behind him feels that sense of responsibility necessarily to solve the problem, maybe just to manage it. And so that I expect to be a bit of a managed flashpoint during this sit down between President Trump and Xi Jinping. And that's not going to be the only moment of potential tension here. Also, President Trump's America First trade policies are going to be a point of confrontation. We've already heard here at the White House that he plans to press him directly on these issues of intellectual property seizure. That means what? Either Chinese hacking or China pressure to American businesses that if you want to do business here, it comes at a cost in terms of sharing some of your own development and your research and your intellectual property. And the president wants to message around that's not acceptable for the U.S. to do business. And to underscore some of this, the president's taking along with him a number of business leaders to show that other sort of economic power that the United States has, that it's not just a military force, it's an economic one. And so it's really trade in North Korea that are really going to make a lot of headlines and not stop in Beijing.
Of course, China, a huge economic force in itself. We just got half a minute. But what's the as he sits down with Xi Jinping, is this eye to eye now? Are these equals, the U.S. and China? Is China on top?
Right. Well, that Thucydides trap, a rising and existing power, some would say is a rising and a declining power. It really matters on where you sit. And the Chinese, I'm told by the Chinese ambassador here, they really want to clarify the relationship and lay out what Xi Jinping's vision for his country and its role in the world will be.
Clarify the relationship. I don't know. There's a new sheriff in town. I'm not sure what that means. We'll look at it. Margaret Brennan will be winging her way toward Asia on that trip with the president, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Great to have you with us. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier? So even when you're busy, you can still be smart about how you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president headed for Asia, his challenges there, and the great power in Asia and now beyond, China. You can join the conversation in this hour. Who do you think has planned this president's trip to Asia? TripAdvisor? And with a half-staff State Department and all hands on deck for Mueller and taxes, who's informing the president, doing the groundwork as he sets out for Asia and China? Do you fear war in Asia with North Korea, maybe soon? And how do you think China would respond to that, and helpful or not, in the time we have right now? Maybe that war threat or denuclearization of North Korea as number one. This was Secretary of Defense James Mattis visiting the demilitarized zone on the border of North and South Korea just last Friday. Said the U.S. wants to see a diplomatic solution to North Korea. Goal is not war, he says.
Our goal is not war, but rather the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
But North Korea has shown no sign of going for complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. Quite the contrary. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told Fox News on Monday the Trump administration hopes China and other powers in East Asia will pressure North Korea to abandon their nuclear program. Here he was.
The great hope we all have, and they're already doing this, is that the Chinese exert their pressure. They're already observing the sanctions, we know that, to exert pressure on the leadership in North Korea. And we have great hopes for the Russians as well.
Great hopes for Russians, but the great hope, China, when it comes to North Korea. And that's just the beginning of what's on the agenda as the president heads to Asia. Joining us right now from Beijing is Ben Blanchard, senior correspondent for Reuters in Beijing, where he leads their political and diplomatic coverage. Ben Blanchard, in Beijing, in China, thank you very much for being with us. It's great to have you. What's the anticipation of President Trump's trip in the halls of power in China?
There's definitely a huge amount of anticipation here for this visit. I mean, obviously, the two presidents, it's not the first time they've met. I believe this will be the third time that they've met. As you've been saying, North Korea will, of course, be topping the agenda here. But the interesting thing to remember is that from the Chinese point of view, the Chinese priorities on North Korea are very different from the U.S. priorities on North Korea. The Chinese are undoubtedly extremely unhappy with North Korea for its repeated nuclear and missile tests. But they also look at the U.S. Military drills and the military drills that they've carried out with South Korea as well. And they say, well, you know, you want the North Koreans to back down and stop being as provocative. Well, we look at these military drills that the United States and the South Korea have been doing as equally provocative. And China also gets very irritated when it hears calls from the United States and its allies for them to do more to rein in North Korea. It's interesting that you talk to Chinese officials and Chinese experts about this, and they say, well, the influence that we have over North Korea is actually much more. It's over exaggerated. People think we have much more influence over the North Koreans than we actually do. The North Koreans, they don't listen to us. You have to bear in mind as well that President Xi and Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, they haven't actually met yet, or they may have met previously that we don't know of, but there's been no public confirmation of any meeting. Kim Jong-un hasn't been here, and President Xi has not been to North Korea, at least not since he assumed power in 2012.
Ben, you're there in Beijing. Do we have an expectations problem here then? Because the president and the people, the top folks around him in Washington have been very clear that China is the one that can stop this. China is the one that can defuse this, take this away from a path toward war. And if they don't, the president implying there will be consequences. How does that get resolved? Is there something he can come away with that will actually solve the problem or save face, Ben? Or could it be an open failure?
Well, I mean, as far as the Chinese are concerned, it really takes two to tango here. They've come up with this proposal called the Joint Suspension Proposal, which is that North Korea suspends its nuclear and missile tests, and at the same time the Americans and the South Koreans suspend their military drills. But at the same time, you know, we have seen the Chinese take very tough action against the North Koreans. They have suspended all imports of coal on North Korea. The Chinese Central Bank has told Chinese banks to stop doing any business with North Korea. So the Chinese are very keen to show that they are being responsible, that they are being that they are playing their part, and that they are enforcing the UN sanctions. And China gets extremely upset at any suggestions that they're not properly enforcing sanctions. China also makes the point that if you look at the UN resolutions, the UN resolutions also call for efforts to resume dialogue, and they also say that normal trade with North Korea between China and North Korea should not be impacted, and certainly humanitarian assistance, which China does give a lot of to North Korea, should also not be affected. You know, China's big fear here really is that they have many fears when it comes to North Korea. One of their big fears is, of course, that there is war, which inevitably would spill over and affect China. And the other is that North Korea simply collapses. And if that happens, you're going to get a wave of destabilizing refugees flooding into northeast China. So it's absolutely not in China's interests for that to happen. They don't want North Korea to be nuclear armed, but at the same time, they absolutely do not want war to happen, and they will do everything they can to try and prevent that.
At the same time, the U.S. administration really speaking aggressively, more aggressively than maybe ever, about North Korea in the last couple of months. And just last Friday, we had Vice President Mike Pence at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, of course, big nuclear weapons center for the states there, talking about the power of the U.S. nuclear arsenal.
There's no greater element of American strength. There's no greater force for peace in the world than the United States nuclear arsenal. This bedrock of freedom deters potential adversaries, protects and assures our allies, and it proves every day to the world that the United States has both the will and the firepower to annihilate any existential threat to our people or our homeland.
Now, you could say, well, that's boilerplate. That's the way American leaders talk about the nuclear arsenal. But we're at a very particular time here. Ben Blanchard is in Beijing, China, for Reuters there, senior correspondent for them. Susan Shirk joins us right now as well from La Jolla, California, chair of the 21st Century China Center at the University of California, San Diego, was deputy assistant secretary of state, responsible for U.S. policy toward China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Mongolia, back in the years leading up to 2000. Susan Shirk, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you make of the meeting of these two leaders at this time? Xi Jinping just coming out of this big party congress where they're talking about China emerging now as a mighty force, a new era. He says an era that sees China moving closer to center stage in his speech, blazing a trail for other countries, very critical of Western values of democracy, free speech. What's happening is these two sit down with the North Korea shadow over everything.
Well, it would be a very difficult moment for any president to be visiting China because, as you note, Xi Jinping was just crowned as the emperor of China.
More or less.
He has abandoned the process of peaceful succession. He didn't pick a successor to get ready for 5 years from now. So he's clearly indicated that he doesn't plan to step down after the normal two terms. So China has returned to a much more concentrated leadership, indeed a kind of dictatorial leadership. And so Xi Jinping is going to go all out to impress President Trump with this amazing ritual and banquets, and it's going to look really very, very good. And President Trump will, like most visitors to China, Chinese are great at entertaining guests. Mm-hmm. So he's likely to be swept away by the thrill of it all. And, I do worry about that. And because it could be a lost opportunity. This is a moment, actually, when the United States should be making clear that it does care about the North Korea threat, but it also has other interests that China has not paid sufficient attention to, especially the economic relationship and the South China Sea, East China Sea tension over China's expansive maritime claims. So at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump just gave the Chinese a pass.
And chocolate cake. Chocolate cake, too. Let's not forget the chocolate cake.
Okay, yeah. Well, that was an extra side payment there. By publicly saying that we will go easy on other issues if China helps us on North Korea, he gave up all of America's standing and leverage on those issues. Diplomats never link issues that way publicly or even privately. So I think now is a time to undo that damage and to have some good, frank conversations about the economic problems in our relationship as well as the South China Sea.
I mean, I want to ask both of you how that might work, but let's hear the president just for a moment. This was last week, President Trump praising the Chinese president after he took this much greater power at the latest party congress. He was talking with Fox Business just a couple days after the solidification of Xi Jinping's power during China's 19th party congress. Here's President Trump.
He's a powerful man. I happen to think he's a very good person. Mm-hmm. Now, with that being said, he represents China. I represent the USA. So, there's going to always be conflict. But we have a very good relationship. People say we have the best relationship of any president, because he's called president also. Now, some people might call him the king of China, but he's called president. But we have a very good relationship, and that's a positive thing. And it would be good to have that relationship with Russia and other countries, too.
great relationship with the king of China, or whatever status you want to put Xi Jinping on now. Ben Blanchard there in Beijing. Donald Trump may possibly be swept away by the pageantry of visiting China, and of course that's great, but he has these two big asks that it appears to me to be difficult to smooth over. And one is, China, are you going to do something strong on North Korea and do it soon? And the second is, very immediately on trade, the president extremely outspoken about the U.S. trade deficit. I mean, he could come home with some baubles, some Christmas ornaments here in terms of deals, but is China really going to change their trade policy? Are they really going to change their North Korea policy, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, on North Korea, I don't think there's much. We haven't seen any sign, particularly that China is going to take a different tack towards North Korea. North Korea does serve a very valuable role for China. It does act as a buffer state. You know, there's a sort of perhaps a slightly old-fashioned concept. But China's fear, one of China's many fears with North Korea, the whole North Korea issue, is that actually if you did end up seeing a unified Korea, you could potentially end up with U.S. troops along the Chinese border, which is absolutely not something they want to see. So the Chinese don't like North Korea particularly, but it does solve this. It does serve this very valuable purpose. There hasn't really been any sign of a substantive shift in China's policy towards North Korea. I'm not sure we're going to see one when President Xi and President Trump sit the next with each other. I mean, on the other issue of trade as well, you're quite right. You talk about baubles and stuff. Of course,
It could be billions, but still.
Yeah, well, exactly. We do expect there to be, and this is what we've reported, and this is exactly what we're expecting. And this, of course, will be something very good for China for President Xi to show to President Trump and say, look, we're taking your concerns seriously, and we want to help create jobs in the United States with these massive orders. But you talk to the U.S. business community here, and they're very nervous about this. Or they're very nervous generally about the Trump administration. They say, as Susan was saying earlier, a lot of the key positions, they're not in place. The U.S. business community here, Western business community here, generally has huge concerns about Chinese practices, whether that's the upcoming ban on VPNs, which is how foreign companies essentially access the outside world because of the Chinese internet censorship. And they think that the U.S. administration is not taking these concerns seriously enough.
You have to wonder where it goes. Larry in Detroit. Larry, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think we have to factor in here that there's a definite bias against Trump, and I think that bias is so strong with some of your commentators that they forget that the man has literally spent his entire life negotiating deals.
Yeah.
And I'd hazard a guess that he probably knows more about negotiating than they do. I think when you're looking at China, which, although they're waving their red flags about the strong socialist ideals and their new leader,
yeah,
90% of their economy is driven by a capitalist model.
Yeah.
And they need their biggest customer in the world, who happens to be led by an orange-haired guy. And I think that that's a pretty strong negotiating point compared to Korea, that buys oil and begs for everything else from them.
Yeah, I mean,
I think you have to consider that. And I think you have to consider that North Korea is making a lot of noise, and it's that out of control teenager from a Chinese perspective that is ruffling feathers. And I don't know that they're going to accept expanding into a nuclear event.
I mean, but North Korea is already sending up the missiles and maybe has a hydrogen bomb. But I take it, Larry, Susan, what about Trump's the great negotiator? So here he goes. We're the biggest customer. Use the leverage.
Well, I agree that the United States has quite a lot of leverage, and I think we need to use it more effectively. And the problem with the economic relationship between the U.S. and China right now is that it's very difficult to think about how to pressure China in a way that doesn't also harm ourselves. And also that we need to focus on the Chinese policies as a systemic problem. We need to be talking with China about their industrial policy of China in 2025, which aims to strengthen the competitiveness of Chinese companies at the expense of international companies. So, you know, we need to be more effective at how we address these problems. The trade deficit per se is not the issue. It's China's industrial policy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president, President Trump, headed for Asia, his challenges there and the great power in Asia, and now beyond China. Ben Blanchard is with us. He's senior correspondent for Reuters in Beijing. Joins us today from Beijing in China, leads their political and diplomatic coverage there. Susan Shirk is with us, chair of the 21st Century China Center at the University of California, San Diego. Deep, long experience in dealing with China. You can join us as well. What do you think? Is an all-powerful Chinese president Xi Jinping going to cut deals with President Donald Trump? Have you followed Xi's consolidation of power in China? What does that portend for China, for the region, for the U.S.? Do you fear war in Asia with North Korea, maybe soon? How do you think China would respond to that? Susan, Ben, lots of response from people online here. Wynn says, China has conquered, quote-unquote, the world without as much as firing off a single shot. What does that say of Washington? Amy says, oh boy, this trip makes me nervous on Twitter. No telling what the president, she uses a less honorific term here, is going to say or tweet. Tracy says he may be making his getaway. Not sure he should be traveling right now. Maybe she's thinking of Robert Mueller and all the rest. On Monday, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly was talking with Fox News, said trade will be a big part of the President Trump's agenda when he visits China.
They beat us pretty badly in terms of trade. That doesn't make them an enemy. They are, to say the least, a world power. That doesn't make them an enemy. They're probably in many ways have been smarter than we are in terms of business and trade. President Trump is committed to changing that relationship on a collegial basis. The disparity between what we buy and sell from them is very great. But by no means are they, I wouldn't even consider them competitors necessarily, just simply another world power.
Not even competitors. Everything sounds okay there, but okay. Not competitors. We'll talk about that. But we've got Rex Tillerson in India, sort of, around the corner there in the south from China in October, with a very different tone on China, undermining international rules-based order, he said.
China's provocative actions in the South China Sea directly challenge the international law and norms that the United States and India both stand for. The United States seeks constructive relations with China, but we will not shrink from China's challenges to the rules-based order. And where China subverts the sovereignty of neighboring countries and disadvantages the U.S. and our friends.
There you go. So what's it going to be when they arrive? Ben Blanchard, what about the notion of China, John Kelly there saying, not being a competitor to the U.S.? How does that strike you sitting in Beijing?
Also, you were playing the comments from Secretary of State Tillerson when he was in India, and this is something that does really concern China. I mean, the Chinese look at U.S. engagement with India at the moment, particularly, but they also look on their own to their east, and they look at the strong U.S. alliances with Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, of course, and these days Vietnam as well, and other parts of Southeast Asia like Singapore. And China really feels that a fear that it's being contained by the United States. I believe actually earlier this week, the Chinese ambassador in Washington, Sui Tian-kai, actually addressed this publicly, saying that we don't want to be contained by the United States. This is a feeling that the Chinese had for a long time. This is not a new issue. But when you get somebody like Rex Tillerson showing up in India and making these comments, it does upset China. And China did actually express some concern in public about what the Secretary of State Tillerson had said. There's a lot of mistrust there, certainly from the Chinese side. There is a lot of, they don't quite
know what to make of U.S. Intentions. I mean, the issue of Taiwan obviously hasn't gone away. At the moment, we have earlier this week, we had the Taiwan president going to Hawaii. She's actually stopping by in Guam tomorrow on her way back to Taiwan after visiting some of Taiwan's diplomatic allies in the South Pacific. And these are all kinds of things that the Chinese look at and think, well, you know, the Americans say they want to be friends with us and they don't want to be competitors, but we look at these things and think, well, you know, what do the Americans really want from us? And, you know, they may say one thing but actually do something else.
I mean, the president talks in much more competitive, confrontational terms. And Susan, what is it? China contained here? That wasn't the sound to my ear of Xi Jinping at the Party Congress recently. I mean, he's talking there about now a new era, about China being a mighty force in the world, blazing a trail for other countries to follow, a nation that now stands tall and firm in the East. This doesn't sound like a contained power, Susan.
Mm. No, I think the work report that Xi Jinping gave at the Party Congress recently concluded was really something very new, a new kind of face of China in the world, much more ambitious, clearly ambitious, and not being embarrassed about being ambitious, but also trying to put a benevolent face on it, that it would help improve human welfare. And China, through the Belt and Road Initiative, building infrastructure on other continents, hopes to enhance its influence, but in a constructive way. And certainly, if it's welcomed by other countries and it's done according to international law and international standards mm-hmm. of finance, you know, more power to them, frankly. We should be doing more of that ourselves.
Yep.
So a certain amount of economic competition and diplomatic competition can be a healthy thing. But then the challenge is to say to Xi Jinping, as I hope President Trump does, is, well, you know, what about your own economy? You spoke at Davos, made this wonderful speech about the open economic order.
Xi Jinping
but
did.
Xi Jinping did.
As Trump was retreating into protectionist talk.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But, you know, in China itself, mm-hmm. the playing field has now become very skewed against international firms,
yeah.
and you're engaging in your own form of protectionism. The other thing I want to mention mm-hmm. about Xi Jinping's speech at the Party Congress is that for the first time in decades, China's coming out and saying that its system, its values, its Marxist, Leninist, Mao Zedong thought, its non-democratic system is superior to Western-style democracy, and it offers a viable alternative to other countries. This is the kind of ideological competition we really haven't seen since the Cold War. So I would hope that President Trump would also talk about this and make clear that the United States continues to exemplify the values of democracy, open economic order, rules-based order. And that's the problem with the America First kind of slogan. I mean, if we are dealing with China on our own, in isolation
yep.
from our allies and multilateral institutions, I'd say we'll never be successful. So we need to work together with other countries based on the rules-based international order.
But can this president, is he an effective bearer of that torch of democracy and rules-based order? I mean, he expresses a lot of admiration for strong men, whether it's Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping. And just in the last couple of days, but lots of impatience with the traditional U.S. rules-based order.
No, I agree. It's worrisome because the Trump administration and the way American politics is working now is actually a negative model for those democratic values and for American leadership in the world. So the president would have to change the way he expresses himself, but not just his words, but what his true belief is. If he could talk like Secretary of State Tillerson and really believe it, you know, that would be a whole lot better.
And what about straight-up power? I mean, the Washington Post, Simon Denyer asks, is China about to replace the United States as the dominant power in the Asia-Pacific? What do you say, Susan?
I say no. I'd say that China's neighbors want to do business with it. China has become the center of increasingly integrated global economy, regional economy, main trading partner for almost all Asian countries. But most Asian countries are also suspicious of Chinese intentions. They don't want to see the restoration of a kind of hierarchical system in Asia with China at the top. They want the U.S. to be there to play a constructive role in a more kind of multipolar system where Japan, India, China, the United States, Russia, South Korea, you know, work together to build a stable and peaceful region.
Can that work? The president canceled the big trade deal, TPP, that sort of wove the whole region together under U.S. aegis. Can you have that multipolar American strength there without TPP? It's gone.
Well, you know, I haven't completely given up on TPP, and neither have the Japanese and a number of other countries. So who knows? I mean, eventually we may get back to it. It was a huge mistake to abandon it, but I, just like the climate deal, the global climate deal, we haven't formally pulled out of it yet. That decision actually will be made by the next president, whoever he or she will be.
Yeah.
So, you know,
you're on the ropes.
I'm an optimist.
You sure are. Hey, Susan, hold the thought. And Ben, callers for the two of you. Bill in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Bill, and your patience. I'm keeping people waiting here. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Mm-hmm. My concern is that while the president comes to the job with some job skills, he doesn't have the right toolbox for the house he's living in. I spent some time doing some international development work in the Middle East, and so I got a brief insight as to how diplomatic actions work. And it's clear that the president and conceivably many of his advisors are not well equipped to be able to act with things like the powers like China and Russia. I mean, look how well he's done with Puerto Rico. If he can't deal with that, what the heck can we expect from him from much grander scale operations?
Bill, we've got it. Let me get one more. Hayes in Marshfield, North Carolina. Hayes, you're on.
Hey, Tom. This president scares me like nobody else. Everybody says that he's a great deal maker, but he's not. I mean, he's a businessman, and he makes deals, and he comes to an agreement, and then he's been sued like 35,000 times for reneging on the deal. You can do that as a businessman, and the other side doesn't come at you with weapons or embargoes or the like. He can't do that with China or North Korea or anybody else. He's not a great businessman.
Hayes, we got it. And one more, Amir in Charleston, South Carolina. Amir, thank you, Hayes. Amir, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
I agree with some of these past callers. I mean, he's going up. You know, President Trump has been proven to not only not be reliable in truth-telling, he's pulling us out of the Iran deal and the climate deal. And he may have been an effective real estate guy, but this is not a real estate transaction or a deal. And he's dealing with, you know, titans, people who are career politicians and diplomats who know the ins and outs, both of the history and of all the complicated relationships that he has no idea about. And I'm sure he doesn't know the language or the culture. And I think it's potentially going to be another embarrassment that he's going to save himself from by something not going.
Amir, we've got it. Your line's breaking up. Ben Blanchard, your perspective from Beijing. How will we know? Let's just take China. How will we know if President Trump has done well or been taken for a ride?
That's a very interesting question. That's a very key question. The Chinese are certainly very keen, will be very keen to show that this meeting is successful for both countries.
Okay.
They certainly won't want anybody to come away with the impression that it's, I mean, China always talks about, you know, this is not a zero-sum game. There's not a I win, you lose kind of scenario. So China will, you know, there will be big business deals. We know that these are coming. I would imagine that there will be some kind of, inevitably President Xi will, and the Chinese will talk about North Korea. They will reiterate their promises to stand by the UN sanctions or the UN resolutions against North Korea. In China, it will be shown to the public as being a great success. And it was interesting that when Secretary of State Tillerson was visiting China at the end of September, when he met President Xi, one of the things President Xi said to him was, you know, I consider President Trump to be a friend. So, both presidents seem to have hit it off, and the Chinese want to be good hosts. Absolutely, the Chinese want to be good hosts.
I don't know how far that goes. Friends, I mean, maybe. That's great. Susan, what will you be looking for in a couple of words here?
I'd like to see the start of a serious economic discussion at the systemic level about the role of the Chinese state in the economy, not just a bunch of baubles and business deals.
But do you see China entering into that after this party Congress?
Yes.
They just affirmed the other way, didn't they?
Well, they just showed some ability to compromise with THAAD and South Korea. We didn't have a chance to discuss
the
that
missile system.
This hour. So maybe this is a moment where Xi Jinping is going to recognize that for the sake of domestic reform, you need to have that discussion as well.
That would be huge. Susan Shirk at University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much, as always, Susan, for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Ben Blanchard with Reuters in Beijing. Ben, thank you very much for your time and thoughts this hour.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Listeners, thank you so much for all your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.